You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
And we filmed a May Day demonstration, which was organised by a small group of leftists, and it was just attacked by the police with incredible brutality, and they just smashed people's cameras. I managed to get off with the film still in the camera, and I was amazed that I wasn't shot.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com.
In this episode, we welcome back John Green, who told us about his covert reporting for East Germany. The story continues with trips to Portugal to cover the Carnation Revolution, a military coup, a dangerous assignment to Chile under General Pinochet, as well as visits to Nicaragua, the United States and Poland. Don't miss the story of Jack Ryan. It's nothing to do with the Tom Clancy character, but it's a really interesting tale. Before we start, I'd like to thank our latest Patreon, who is pinito.me. Patreons are listeners like you who are supporting the podcast with their monthly donations starting from a pound or a dollar. Just head over to coldwarconversations.com and click on the Support the Podcast menu option to learn more. If that's not your cup of tea, then you can also help us by leaving a review in iTunes or with your favourite podcast provider. It really does help us get new guests on the show. So, back to today's episode. We join my Cold War conversation with John Green as he describes the Carnation Revolution in Portugal. So we've talked about South Africa and some of the work you did there. Portugal's an interesting country because it was under a dictatorship. I think it's Salazar.
Yes.
And then there was a left-wing military coup, which is not a phrase you often hear of.
No, it took everybody by surprise. I mean, Salazar was the longest-serving dictator in Europe for 40 years, and then Cayetano, who was another right-wing dictator, took over shortly before the coup. And we had filmed in Portugal under the dictatorship, and it was, as in Greece, it was very difficult to film and very difficult to find people you could talk to because they were obviously very scared. But we managed to, as soon as we heard about the coup, we managed to fly out there, and we got there only a couple of days later. And it was the most incredible experience for me because you had soldiers everywhere on the streets with carnations in their gun barrels and being embraced and kissed by all the women and the girls, and people on the streets, everyone who was talking animatedly on the street corners. You could feel that was, people felt this sudden relief that the dictatorship had finished. It was a time of incredible euphoria. The prisons were opened, political prisoners were being released. I went over there with two Portuguese young journalists who'd been working for the BBC foreign broadcasting service here, and they were embraced by all their friends at the airport who hadn't seen them for years. And they actually found their own files in the Secret Service department when we went with them. They were obviously on the blacklist. So it was all these, and then hearing the stories of the ex-political prisoners, what they did, the torture they'd undergone under the dictatorship. It was amazing. It was just, you couldn't put the camera down. There was just so much to film.
No, and it must have been an amazing moment because it's like being there when the revolution is happening. You're not recording something that happened in the past, and for all your beliefs, it was sort of like seeing those being enacted there in front of your camera in another country.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, it reminded me of what it must have been like for John Reed or any of the reporters who were in Russia in 1917, because you felt that, because the army was doing it. They were on the streets, but they were obviously very much part of the people, because the Portuguese army was a conscript army still. So most of the ordinary soldiers weren't happy there. It was part of their military service. And so they were part of the people, and the people felt that, and they felt that the army had launched this coup on their behalf. And so that was, yeah, incredibly invigorating.
Mm. And you also did some work in Nicaragua. So that was after the Sandinistas had got to power, or was that before?
Yes, that was after the Sandinistas got to power, but the civil war was still continuing because the Contras, financed by the Americans, were still fighting in the country, and people were still being killed. Bombs were going off. So it was still a pretty fraught situation. You couldn't just travel anywhere throughout the country. You had to be very careful where you were moving. But again, it was thrilling to see a country trying to rebuild itself from the ashes. And that's why this civil war, particularly with American finance, the Contras, was so debilitating, and those repercussions are still being felt today.
Yeah, yeah. Because I believe Ortega's still, or is he in power?
Ortega's
now?
Still in power, though the Sandinistas split. They had big problems. I mean, they were destabilized, as I say, by the Contras and the Americans, and basically the country was economically on its knees. And then you had, in the meantime, a right-wing government. And then Ortega came back into power, but he split from his former comrades, and there are big differences now about what he's doing.
Right, right. So he's not of, is he still of the Marxist persuasion?
Yes, he still calls himself a Marxist, and still it's still a Sandinista government. But it's, to me, it seems a little more dictatorial than it should be. Although he's, he works closely with Venezuela, and the Americans obviously hate him because of his socialist ideas. But it's a sort of civil war situation almost.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah. And staying in South America, I was interested to hear about your time in Chile. Can you share some of that?
Yes. Well, again, it was. We went to Chile when Pinochet was still in power to show what a dictatorship is really like, a fascist dictatorship, what it does to people. And that was quite difficult to film because we tried to get press credentials, which they didn't give us, but they said we could film basically what we wanted. But Pinochet was still very much in power, and we filmed a May Day demonstration, which was organized by a small group of leftists, and it was just attacked by the police with incredible brutality. And that was one of the occasions where the press wasn't treated with kid gloves, and they just smashed people's cameras. And I just grabbed my camera and ran, and my colleague who had the sound equipment, his microphone was torn out of his hand, and he was bashed around by the thugs that the police employed. I managed to get off with the film still in the camera, and I was amazed that I wasn't shot because there were soldiers with machine guns on every street corner. But why they didn't do anything to me, I don't know, and I managed to find a taxi and escape back to the hotel with the film still intact. But that was also a scary moment. But we were able to talk to quite a few people working underground. They're lawyers, human rights lawyers, and young socialists, young communists who were working against the regime, who were willing to talk to us. And they were very suspicious of us, because we know that because the Chilean embassy actually rang our office here in London to inquire about us, because they were a bit suspicious who we were. But they, again, we managed to get out of the country, and they didn't take any film off us. So it was quite successful.
Right. Because I think you said that you were filming Pinochet. You managed to get some footage.
Yes, it was amazing. He was taking the salute from a new group of young police cadets that had just done their training, and we read about it in the newspaper, and we just turned up and pushed our way to the front, and found myself filming Pinochet marching in front of the young cadets with my camera under his nose, and he didn't look very happy at all. He didn't like it, but he did. He presumed we'd got permission, which we hadn't. But we managed to.
Little did he know that it was East German TV
exactly
right in front of him. Wow.
Yes, because that was the additional worry for us, because if anybody did find out, we would be for the high jump.
So did people not realise that you were working for GDR TV? Presumably you didn't tell anybody outside of the GDR who you were actually working for, and you were just sort of like a freelance business filming documentary footage. Was that what you were... That was almost your cover.
Yes. I mean, with people we trusted, we did tell them. But obviously, when you're filming in the United States or in a fascist country like Pinochet's Chile, you couldn't afford to do that. But what we did do, which was basically the truth, even though only half the truth, is we said, look, we're an independent company, and we sell our footage to whoever's interested in taking it. Mm. So that basically let us off the hook. We weren't telling direct lies, but we obviously didn't tell them what the end purpose was.
Okay. And you mentioned the USA. So you did a few visits to the USA. What would you say were the most memorable visits you did there?
Well, I think there were several, but I mean, one we did on the peace movement and the movement of the bishops and the progressive Catholic Church in America, trying to stop the the arms race. Mm-hmm. So we did a lot of interviews with people in various places. We also did a documentary on racism in North Carolina, where, as still today, but even then, black people were just being imprisoned for all sorts of minor offences with enormous draconian sentences. And particularly if they were progressive people, like Ben Chavis was the one film we made about Ben Chavis, who's a young preacher from North Carolina, who was imprisoned, I think, for 20 years because he was supposedly involved in arson, where a few horses were burnt. And that was the sort of draconian sentences they were being given. So that was interesting. We talked to white people as well about what they felt about race, and it was still a very racist state in those days. Very, very, very much more so, obviously, than it is today. We also did a film on the border with Mexico, which is interesting because that's now with Trump is in the news again. And this was, in a sense, as far as our GDR contractors were concerned, it was an alibi for them because the wall was obviously under attack because you don't, you know, a wall erected in a country to stop people leaving or stop people coming in is certainly not a nice thing. And they thought, well, let's do a film about the border where the Americans are trying to stop all the Mexicans and other immigrants coming in. So that was quite an interesting film because, you know, it showed the way they were using technology they'd developed in Vietnam with sensors in the ground and night sights and everything to track the migrants coming across the border, who were then arrested by immigration and sent back to Mexico.
Because the GDR portrayed the wall as the anti-fascist rampart to stop...
As a defence wall, exactly.
Yeah, so it was a direct allegory of...
Yes, it was a comparison. Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what they felt, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it's not a good comparison, in my opinion.
Well,
but
I can see the angle that they were trying to get at there. I mean, I did note down here that you did something with Generals for Peace where you were filming nuclear missile silos.
Yes. Yes, that was an organisation which was, as you say, Generals for Peace. It was a number of German, French, Belgian, American and British generals. The British one was General Harbottle, who we flew to America with him, and General Gerhard Bastian, who became a member of the Green Party and committed suicide, unfortunately. Then there was Admiral La Roche, I think his name was, in the States. And we visited again, we visited various communities where these missiles were stationed. One, I remember a lady in Wisconsin had this enormous farm, and she took us out to these silos where, you know, they were on her farm. And she said, look, I've got my kids here. This is, if this is, you know, we're a prime target having these missiles on our land. Mm. She'd become a very strong peace activist, people like that. Yeah.
I think you tell in the book there's a conflict there because her husband was.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Not necessarily, but, you know, she was,
that's right,
become the peace activist, and he was fine with having this
yes,
stuff there.
Yes, he wasn't happy about that at all.
Yeah. So family split there.
Absolutely, yes.
I wrote down the name Jack Ryan, and I know it's not the Tom Clancy character.
No.
Can you tell me about this Jack Ryan?
Yes, he was a an FBI man who had been asked to spy on the peace activists in America, and because they'd been organizing demonstrations outside army recruitment centers and calling for opposition to to the armaments industry and nuclear weapons, and Jack was spying on them, and he got to know quite a number of them, and he himself was a Catholic. And realized that many were motivated by Christian principles and that they were doing no harm to America and didn't want to do harm to America. They just wanted to stop the arms race. And he told his superiors that he didn't feel it was right that they should be spied on because they're not endangering states in any way. And he was eventually sacked and lost his pension, but still stuck to his principles. So we did a portrait of him, yeah. And he was in a poor state mentally and psychologically because he was now ostracized from all his mates from his time at the FBI because he was a true American patriot who believed that's why he joined the FBI. That's what he wanted to do.
That's an interesting story, that, because, I mean, that's one of the things I'm trying to cover within the podcast is some of these stories that people have never heard of. And until I'd read your book, the only Jack Ryan I knew was the Tom Clancy character. And this individual sounds as brave, perhaps more so than, you know, any fictional character. So I'll be delving more into that or see what more I can find out about that story.
Well, if you check out the magazine Mother Jones, because they did a big portrait of him, that's how we picked it up. It's quite a well-known magazine.
Yeah.
But yes, I mean, he was an all-American guy. You know, he believed in the system. He wasn't political at all, but just came to realize that peace was a big issue and these were genuine people. So it was a very tragic case in many ways.
Mm. You did some filming in Afghanistan. Now, was that after the Soviet invasion?
No, this was before. Actually, that was a bit of a farce, really, because we were supposed to. It was after the first Afghan coup against the against the king, who was quite a backward conservative, and it was a military coup again, but a small group of leftist soldiers who took over, and so we flew out there and wanted to film, but unfortunately, this was one of the rare cases where at the airport they confiscated our film camera, and we weren't able to do any filming, and after 6 days of just sitting around in a hotel doing nothing, we decided to go home.
Documentary filmmaking without a camera was probably quite challenging.
It is very difficult, exactly. So, I mean, we picked up all the atmosphere. I mean, again, it was interesting because there were tanks on the street, but garlanded with flowers, and people seemed very happy at the coup. But we didn't know what was going on because we didn't have an interpreter. As I say, we didn't have a film camera to film, so
right.
It was a bit of a botched job.
Oh, well. I was interested to read about your time in Poland with Solidarity, because obviously that would have been a worry for the GDR government at the time. I mean, how did you cover Solidarity?
Yeah, well, that was a time when I was, to a certain extent, becoming disillusioned with the fact that I thought, felt the communist countries were certainly not moving towards democracy, which I'd hoped, and that the system was as ossified as it always has been. It wasn't changing. The old leadership was really entrenched and they weren't reading the signs, which I could see. There was an increasing dissatisfaction, even in the population of the GDR. And with Poland and Solidarność, even though I wasn't in sympathy with many of the leaders because I think they were Catholic reactionaries, nevertheless, I realised that the communist regime in Poland was unpopular, had been right from the start, and there was certainly no love for the Russians. And so I realised that Solidarność certainly had a popular base, even though it was obviously being promoted by the West and supported financially and everything else by the Americans, because anything which could help undermine the communist system was obviously grist to their mill. But I was very unhappy about characterising it, or supposedly characterising it, as a counter-revolutionary movement, which was basically just financed and put in place by the West, which I didn't believe and, of course, wasn't true. And so we did go over to Poland. We interviewed people from Solidarność and so forth. And we also went to New York to interview people there who were getting support for Solidarność. But it became clear to us that this was, you know, a genuinely popular movement. And we didn't want to continue making the film because we didn't want to pretend that it was anything other than what it was.
Mm. And were they suspicious of you at all?
No, because we were British. Well, I was British. My colleague was West German. They were quite happy to talk to us, yeah.
Yeah, because you mentioned your colleague quite a lot, and forgive me because I haven't even asked about them, but he was West German, so he could travel on his passport as well. And
yes, because all my colleagues were, I mean, we didn't work with East Germans in the main. I mean, we did here in London with their reporters, but normally all the other colleagues were West Germans. And I mean, my main colleague, Klaus, who I was with in Poland, he actually was born in Gdansk, and he'd fought in the Second World War and become, you know, very much an anti-fascist after the war. He was in the communist underground in West Germany. So he was a guy who'd got a lot of experience. So it was very useful for me to work with him and hear about his experiences.
Mm. So he'd fought with the Soviet allied Polish?
No, with the Nazis.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. He was 17 when he was conscripted into the Nazi army.
Okay. So this was when Gdansk was Danzig and
that's right.
Was absorbed into the Reich.
Yeah, yeah. Because there were a lot of Germans living there, obviously, at the time.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, people forget that whole Kaliningrad and Königsberg,
yes, right.
And that was all German
all
territory.
Was,
yeah,
was,
yeah.
Which is now
right
part
up
of
to Latvia, I think.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
Memel,
yeah.
And places, yes, like that. Fascinating history. I mean, I always find it interesting around the, you know, how fluid some of the borders have been.
Yes, yes.
In Europe, and you know how that was Polish once, and yes, now it's Ukrainian, and you know.
I was going to say it's like Ukraine today. You know,
yeah,
you've got Russian-speaking minority, got Crimea, which was always part of Russia, but the Ukraine, it was given by Khrushchev to the Ukraine, and now they're fighting over it again. And,
yeah, it comes around again, and I think that's why I'm, you know, finding quite a lot of interest in this podcast series, mm-hmm, because a lot of the themes we cover are resurfacing again or are caused by what happened in the past during the Cold War. So, for example, you said, you know, with Khrushchev handing the Crimea to the Ukraine.
Whereas, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, if we don't look at our history and learn from it, then we, as the cliche has it, we're obliged to repeat it, and we see ourselves repeating it, you know. I mean, my opinion today, I mean, I'm certainly no friend of Putin, who's, you know, an authoritarian thug. But I think if we fail to understand the Russian mentality and their fear of invasion and everything else and see Putin in that context, then I think we're misreading the present and we're not learning from the history. Mm.
No, I think you're right. I mean, you know, people forget that, you know, NATO have now moved a good 300-400 miles closer to,
that's right,
Russia.
Right,
if you include the Baltic states, there's almost like a pincer movement,
yes,
around. And, and you know, they don't forget,
no,
the 22nd of June 1941 and the Great Patriotic War and
exactly, no,
and all of,
yes,
that history. That's, mm-hmm, still very immediate.
Yes, it is.
To them.
Much more than it is for us in many ways.
I mean, well, you can see it in the you know, the Red Square parades and things like that. There's still that fondness there.
Yes, well, again, if we look at history, the Russians have never had democracy. They had authoritarian czarism, and then the revolution, and then Stalin. They do have faith in a strong leader because they have no sense of democracy and how to build a proper democracy. And we're seeing that now with Putin, and that's why he's got a lot of support. And why, as you say, with Stalin, it's a bit like some people of our Brexiteers who have nostalgia for the empire, and a lot think back on the Stalin era with nostalgia. They forget all the crimes and everything else, and it's understandable in the context.
Well, I think you're right. It's the way history is taught, because certainly when I was at school, you weren't taught about the Bengal famine or anything like that. It was, and this was 60s, 70s, but you didn't cover any of the darker corners of British history, like Ireland and stuff like that. Admittedly, I mean, I was surprised when I did my history, it was social and economic history. Right. So it was Corn Laws, Chartism, stuff like
exactly
that, trade unionism. Which I found surprisingly interesting, because I always thought, well, I'm really only interested in political history and that sort of side of it. So
it's interesting. I mean, we're different generations, but you had obviously the same schooling as I had.
Yeah. Well, I was always surprised. My English literature teacher, we didn't do any Shakespeare at all. None of the classics. We did Graham Greene's Brighton Rock. We did Arnold Wesker, Chicken Soup with Barley.
Oh, wow. Oh, that was very different to mine, because we just did Shakespeare.
Yeah. So looking back on it, I think it was probably quite a left...
Yes.
You know, a left-leaning teacher to take us on that path. So you were talking about your frustration with not being able to cover subjects that you thought were important and should be shown in the GDR. I think it was around not being able to criticize Iraq because they were an ally or they were a friendly power.
Yes, because there was a time when in the early days of Saddam, because he came to power basically with the collaboration of the communists in Iraq, which was quite a strong communist party, and he was the Ba'ath Socialist Party, so-called. And so in the early days, the GDR and the Soviet Union, I think, cooperated with Saddam Hussein, and even helped him set up his secret service network. But it became clearer. Well, he started then persecuting the communists and imprisoning them and assassinating them. But despite that, the GDR still had some form of cooperation with him, which I found quite horrendous. And we were just asked to go and film in the country and give a positive picture, in essence, of the country. And I refused to do that because I knew what was happening. I mean, I got family who had to flee Iraq. Because of the persecution, so I knew what was going on.
And when the wall comes open, where were you at that? How did you hear about that?
I was actually next to the wall on the 9th of November, 1989. We got one of our regular meetings of all the colleagues, the film colleagues. And we were having our meeting there. I mean, it was clear things were bubbling under the surface, but suddenly we heard all these car horns outside and we saw rows of Trabants and Wartburgs moving towards the border. And we realised something must have happened. And that was when the wall was opened. And so that was very clear then. There was no going back to the old GDR. That was now finished.
And what was the immediate reaction of your colleagues to that? Was there a mixture of people who were believers and those that thought that reforms needed to happen?
I think all my Western colleagues were clear that reforms needed to happen. I think my GDR colleagues were stunned and didn't make any immediate comments. They kept their thoughts to themselves. Mm. But we were very clear that things could never be the same again. And so that was, it was a moment of big change in Europe.
I mean, that Schabowski press conference is just a classic example of make sure you've read your notes properly before you...
A classic big mistake, I think. But it wouldn't have changed the history in a sense. It was just
it would have been a day later. Exactly. It would have been announced. So, exactly. You know, he always comes across as the fool guy, you know.
No, I was just pleased and amazed. I mean, this is the thing one has to. It's no praise in a sense of the communist system, but at least these revolutions were peaceful, and they could have gone badly wrong. But I think, you know, one has to recognize certainly the guy who took over from Honecker, Egon Krenz, and the leader of the GDR counter-espionage, Michel Wolff.
Yeah.
They were adamant that no force would be used. And I think that, you know, if guns had been used, then it would have been pretty bloody. But at least it happened peacefully, which was good.
Yeah. I found a fascinating interview on YouTube with Krenz, 2 hours long with English subtitles, which I was extremely grateful for. And it was really interesting. It was a West German journalist interviewing him. But it's just interesting hearing that insight, because obviously you have to take some of these interviews with a little bit of a pinch of salt, because they're looking at things with hindsight and don't necessarily want to share some areas. And Marcus Wolff is an interesting character because I've read his book Spy Without a Face, and I just sense he's sort of he wanted to say things the way that he wanted to be heard rather than giving you the full truth. I think probably the biggest example in there is that he claims that he knew nothing of the sanctuary given to the Red Army faction group in East Germany and the training that they were given in modern weaponry. But an interesting character nonetheless. I mean, he almost tried to portray himself as a reformist after, which I don't know.
Well, he did come out, he was speaking in some of the big meetings in Berlin in 89, calling for reform. And I mean, he was a cultured man, he was intelligent. And he realized, I think, what I was just saying to you, that, you know, this system can't continue. You know, it's just refusing to change and refusing to recognize that we can't continue. And you might say, a little late in the day, but at least he did. He realized what was happening. Unlike his counterpart, Mielke, who was head of the internal part of the Secret Service, which was probably quite a nasty piece of work.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Yes. Yeah, certainly by all accounts. And he was subsequently prosecuted for the murder of a police officer in the 1930s as well. Were you ever approached by the Stasi for anything, you know, asked to inform or, you know, keep an eye on people?
I was approached. I think I mentioned that in my book. I was approached when I first applied to marry my East German girlfriend. I was called before a committee who asked me whether I'd be willing to work for the GDR. And, you know, I wanted to get married, so I wanted to make things easy, because the idea was, well, if you cooperate with us, we'll make it easy for you. But I made it perfectly clear then. I said, well, I support the GDR, support socialism, I'm willing to give the GDR what support I can, but I certainly wouldn't be willing to spy against my own country. Anyway, they accepted that. And basically then I was put in touch with a Stasi man who just chatted to me. It was the usual sort of softening up process, sent me to West Berlin to just see how I'd react, how I would behave. I mean, I was the most useless spy anyway. I wouldn't be the best person to do that sort of thing. But I wasn't asked to inform on anybody. I was asked if I thought any of my colleagues might be worthwhile recruiting. And I mentioned several who I thought might be worth talking to. But I certainly didn't give any personal information about any. And they stopped cooperating with me when we organized a film show, illegal film show in East Berlin. And the Stasi came before we could start showing the films and said, "Nay, stop, pum." And they took all our details and IDs and stopped us showing the films. And we got quite a lot of criticism for that by the chancellor of the film school, saying, "What the hell are we thinking about?" and blah, 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 blah. But there were no repercussions apart from the fact they said, OK, we obviously can't work with you anymore because you didn't tell us about this. And I was quite happy. And that was it.
Yeah, spontaneity is never something that they were particularly fond of.
No,
have you ever looked at your file?
I haven't, no. I was going to, and then it's such a bureaucratic process. In the end, I didn't. But
yeah.
I don't know if anybody else has looked at it. But
yeah. Well, I thought, can other people look at your file? I would have thought it's only if...
It's not easy, but I think you possibly can. I mean, there's a recent film come out in Germany called Gundermann about a quite a well-known GDR folk singer, ballad singer, who was also a Stasi man. And a reporter managed to get hold of his file.
Oh, okay. So,
but I don't know. It's not easy. It's true to get hold of other people's files. But, I mean, you can obviously find out who was informing on you because people have done that. And, I mean, that's caused a hell of a lot of disruption in people's lives, you know, friendships and marriages.
Because I think there's a lot redacted in there.
Yeah.
But obviously by some of the conversations that are recorded, you can potentially work out who was involved.
Yes.
So with the fall of the wall, I mean, what was your view on the future of the GDR? Presumably you felt that there should have been a third way there. So rather than being subsumed into West Germany, that the state would still exist as a more benign.
It would have been nice. I mean, I was dubious right from the start because, you know, it was a one country divided. And although in the meantime there'd been a strong sense of nationalism within the GDR as well as within West Germany, but nevertheless they were part of the same nation, and so there was a strong feeling that people wanted unity. Apart from the fact that West Germany was a very affluent, rich nation, and so the GDR, many people there thought, well, we want part of this wealth as well. Why not? So there was quite a significant minority who would have liked to have pursued a third way. But I didn't think that was feasible. I think things had gone too far. People had become so anti-socialist, particularly in the later years. Young people were feeling more and more frustrated that they couldn't do things that they wanted to do, and they felt they were being monitored all the time. So I realised that that was probably the only alternative, although the way it was done is still pretty devastating because it was a takeover. It was a colonial takeover in many ways. I mean, all the former academics in the GDR, the heads of businesses and universities, they were all dismissed. All lost their jobs, and all these jobs were taken over by West Germans. Often not very competent ones, but it was a great job because if you couldn't get a professorship in West Germany, you could jump into East Germany and get a professorship like that. And so a lot of people did feel very bitter afterwards. And then, of course, all the cooperative farms were broken up. People lost their houses because people came back from the West and said, "Oh, that was my house before the war, so I want it back." You know, a lot of unemployment. A lot of young people had to leave to go to the West to find work. So it was a pretty traumatic period.
So the promises made by the Western politicians didn't materialise?
Some did, some didn't. I mean, obviously travel, which everybody was overjoyed about, is great, and people certainly wouldn't want to go back to being cooped up in a small nation like the GDR. But yeah, a lot of the promises weren't fulfilled. I mean, even today, 30 years after the wall came down, there's still wage differentials, pensions differentials. between the East and West. So it's still, in a sense, treated like second-class citizens in many ways.
Yeah, yeah. And there's still quite a significant vote for Die Linke.
Yes, that's right.
In the East as well. Yes, I think it's 20%.
It was up to 20, 24, 25 in some places. It's sinking a bit now because I think it was mainly the older generation. Mm. Because after all, like in any country, whatever the system, there are quite a few people who lived quite well. And people, you know, if you were part of, you know, you supported socialism and you got a job in government or in the army or whatever, you could have quite a good life, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And there was a stability there.
Exactly.
And cradle to grave.
Safe job, yes, that's right. That's right.
Yeah. In your book, there's a comment where somebody says to you, I think, is through your work you supported the shooting of people at the wall. I got the impression from the book that concerned you, that through some of your work you had supported that.
Yes, it's always a concern for a journalist, you know, the effect your work has on other people. And I mean, I was acutely aware, particularly later stages, and that's why I became dissatisfied to a large extent. I mean, I was happy because I had my own critique of capitalism, and particularly capitalism in Britain with its class system and everything else. So I was quite happy to make that criticism. But I was aware that, even though it was, as far as I was concerned, the truth about this, or partial truth about this country, it was nevertheless being used by the GDR as an alibi for their own system. In the sense, saying, look, you've got stability, we've got full employment, we've got kindergarten, we've got decent housing, but look what it's like in capitalism. On that level, it was true, but it was nevertheless being used as an alibi to justify their system. So if you extrapolate from that, then yes, I could be accused of giving support to a system which did shoot people on the border. You can't. It's the same as, you know, with what happened in the colonial countries, not with our generation, but what happened, you know, we're all responsible, guilty in some ways.
Absolutely.
But I mean, certainly I would have never allowed my reporting to be used, to justify killing on the border, or as some of my colleagues were accused that our films were used by the Stasi or something, or we were doing Stasi work. We never did. Mm. Certainly I didn't, and I wouldn't have justified that in any means. Mm. But, it's a difficult one. With retrospect, as you say, we're all the wiser. And I was, perhaps you can say, naive, rosy-coloured spectacles, you know, hoping for the best when it was never going to happen. But, okay, that's the way it was at the time.
It was a different time.
Yes.
It was a different time. And I think it's difficult for people to look at it in the perspective of the present day to envisage the situation that the GDR was in, certainly in, you know, the 60s when you describe it, where it's still trying to recover from the war damage and that situation.
And it was ostracized by the West. You know, it couldn't get investment, it couldn't import goods. I mean, the West Germans cut off coal supplies in one of the harshest winters after the war, and they had no other recourse. So it was that sort of thing that was happening. So it was like a war, a cold war, as you as your website's called. It was definitely, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And how would you describe your political beliefs now?
I'm still a socialist. I'm a member of the Labour Party, and I am a socialist with many qualifications. I don't have any illusions about how difficult it is to build a more just society or a more democratic society. And I certainly have no faith in, never did have actually, but I certainly don't have any faith in individuals who offer us a panacea, whether it's Trump or Putin or anybody else. You know, I think people have to create the democracy that they want to live in. We all have to make that contribution. Yeah, that said, I mean, as I say, I don't regret the time I worked for the GDR. It was, for me, an incredible experience, and it was, in a sense, an experiment that failed. But there was a lot of positive as well, which I don't feel I have to apologise for.
This is my last question. You'll be delighted to know. But what of all the documentary pieces you've filmed, what would you say is the one you're probably most proud of?
I think
it can be more than one.
I was going to say it's actually two. As we've mentioned earlier, we made several, but the Portuguese 74 revolution was the most inspiring because we spent months in the country, filmed thousands of feet of film, and actually charted the movement through to when it first had a democratic government again. And so that was an incredibly historically important lesson of how democracy can be built, how it can work, what overcoming dictatorship really means. And the other one was in Namibia, where, you know, it was at that time a forgotten country. It was being run basically by the South Africans by default, because it shouldn't have been. It was supposed to be run by the United Nations. And the people there were, you know, desperate to have freedom from apartheid and run their own country. And we had very moving moments, conversations and interviews with people working for Namibian Liberation Movement in Namibia. And the film was actually used by Sean McBride in the United Nations during the campaign to get South Africa out of the country and to give the country its independence. And it was recognized as a film which demonstrated clearly that the people were behind the freedom movement. It wasn't just a little terrorist organization, as the South Africans characterized it.
Mm. Well, John, you certainly whetted my appetite to dig into that Brandenburg archive. To have a look at these. I really appreciate you sharing your story with us on Cold War Conversations. Thank you very much.
I've really enjoyed it, Ian. Thank you.
Well, that's it for today's episode. Don't forget to visit the show notes at coldwarconversations.com, where there's further details of this week's episode and links to John's book, which I highly recommend. We only really scratched the surface in our chat. If you can't wait for the next episode, do visit our Facebook discussion group, where our guests and listeners like you continue the Cold War conversation. Just go to coldwarconversations.com and click on the Join the Conversation option. We're also keen to chat with you on Twitter. Our handle there is @ColdWarPod, and we're also on Instagram @ColdWarConversations. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.